أشهد أن محمد رسول الله. أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.
Welcome to another edition of Islam in Focus. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you. Today we continue with our seventh program in our series dealing with the sources of Islam. We're dealing with the topic of authorship of the Quran, and more specifically we'll be looking at the question of personal religious experience and visions as a possible source of the Quran. I have joining me on the program, as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum. Could you very quickly summarize the main points that we discussed in our program last week?
Sure. We continued to look into the various explanations that tried to give some source of the Quran other than revelation,
trying to reconcile the fact that the Prophet claimed it's coming from Allah, from God, vis-a-vis what they tried to prove that it's not. And we discussed one of those theories, for example, trying to relate that to visions like Joan of Arc, and we indicated again that the analogy is far from relevant. We discussed the theories offered by such Orientalists as Birmingham and Tor Andre, where they somehow claim that the Prophet convinced himself that he will be the reformer and be the Prophet, and as such this vision just began to materialize in his own mind. And we tried to explain the erroneous interpretation, or this erroneous interpretation, on both historical and logical grounds. We analyzed first the fact that there are so many things in the Quran which pertain to past history, and history does not emanate from oneself. History has to be taught or learned by the person somehow. We looked also into the fact that there are certain prophecies in the Quran, none of which was proven to be inaccurate, and all of them came to pass, or at least those that their time came has come to pass with great accuracy. And we indicated again that prophecies are not something that the person invents. I mean, you might derive it once or twice, but to be consistent in that shows a different source than your own thinking. Well, on this question of prophecies, it's very interesting, and I wonder if perhaps we could explore just a little bit more. I'd like to ask you if there are prophecies in the Quran which are even more specific than those that we discussed last time,
towards the end of the last program.
Yes, there are. In fact, in chapter 30, or surah 30 in the Quran, it's called the Ar-Rum, or the Romans. It's an interesting case, really, because when you compare it with what actually happened in history, you find striking accuracy. See, at the time when Muslims were not really strong enough, and they were still, even during the Meccan period, about 614 in the Christian calendar, at that time the Roman Empire was soundly defeated by the Persian. In fact, the defeat was so bad that many people thought that the Roman Empire is basically finished. For example, in the year 610, the Persians had stunning victories, and they dominated so many parts that were under the Roman rule, including, for example, Egypt and North Africa. And like I said, there was no hope really apparent. It is under these circumstances that the first few verses or passages of that surah number 30, it says that the Romans have been defeated, but they will win again, and they will have victory again in a few years. The original Arabic word for a few is bid'a, bid'a sinid. Bid'a in Arabic means 3 to 9. Anywhere between the range of 3 years to 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to notice that despite of this defeat of the Romans, the Arabs were happy with that, of course, the pagans, because they were pro-Persians, and of course Persians were closer in their thinking to their pagan practice than the Romans were Christians, and perhaps would be closer to people who believe, at least in some form of revelation of that nature. And what happened is that, according to historians, for example, we refer to Gibbon's, G-I-B-B-O-N, in the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, in which it is stated that about 7 years after that prophecy, that is about 621-22, there was a battle in which, surprisingly, the Roman won against the Persian. It's a place called Issus, or I-S-S-U-S.
Mm-hmm.
Not only this, 2 years later, the Roman were able to penetrate even the Persian Empire, and they reached so many places that were already under their rule, like Mosul, for example, which is now in Iraq. So notice here, first of all, the prophecy that the Romans will win even though they were soundly defeated.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, that this victory will take place, that there will be war to start with, because nobody could have predicted there would be war within this few years, within, maximum 9 years. And that the Romans, despite of their weakness, will actually be the winners in that war. Nobody could just, speculate and put all of these things, and no military expert, no matter how much experience, maybe you might say, all right, in such and such time, this battle was going to take place, and who's going to be the winner. But there's something equally stunning about that particular passage, because it ends by saying that in that day, the believers also will be happy with the victory of God. And when you consider the 9 years after the prophecy was made, at the same time that the Romans were defeating the Persians, simultaneously, Muslims also were having their stunning victory against the pagans in the very famous battle called the Battle of Badr, where there is mention of it in the Quran, where Muslims were outnumbered more than 3-1, ill-armed and ill-equipped. And they had a brilliant victory, which was, of course, due, as the Quran explained it, to divine intervention above all. So what kind of a wise person can make such a kind of prophecies with that accuracy, with what will happen about the same time? It's something that it's just beyond any human capacity, if it were true that the Prophet was the author of the Quran. And by the way, this is not the only prophecy about the punishment of the unbelievers, or even the Battle of Badr itself and their sound defeat in that battle.
Mm-hmm. Well, on this last point, with respect to the Battle of Badr, could you explain that a little bit more?
Well, for example, elsewhere in the Quran, in Surah 54, particularly in verse 45, it makes a prediction, a clear prophecy. سَيُهْزَمُ الْجَمْعُ وَيُوَلُّونَ الدُّبُرُ. The multitude will be defeated and they will show their backs. They will be running away or flee and will show their backs. The interesting part about it is that this verse, or this passage, was revealed in Mecca at the time when Muslims were so few, mm-hmm. and almost helpless, and there was no anticipation whatsoever that there would be any, confrontation, really, military confrontation between them and the pagans who sought to destroy them. Nobody predicted that at this time at all, to the point that one of the close companions of the Prophet, Umar, when he heard the verse, he said, أَيُّ جَمْعٍ هَذَا? He said, what kind of multitude is that? He never thought that a war would take place. Even before that, one of the very earliest revelations of the Quran, in Surah Al-Anfal, that's Surah number 8, as you find it in the Quran. And the last passage in that ayah, or in that surah, that's number 20, specifically says that Allah knows that some of you believers will be very tired during the day seeking their living. Some will be traveling, some will be fighting in the path of Allah.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the reason why the night prayer was relaxed a little bit, that they don't have to stay most of the night, that they can pray whatever they can at night. But the interesting part about it is the prophecy very early, before any notion of fighting would have occurred to the mind of anyone, that there will eventually be a military confrontation between the Muslims and the pagans,
mm-hmm.
and this actually did come to pass. Another equally stunning surah in the Quran, number 44, especially from Ayah 10 on, it describes a prophecy that came to pass with the minutest details. What it says basically that wait, in response to their disbelief, wait until the sky will bring forth a sort of mist or smoke that will engulf them, that this will be a time of great suffering and difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says that there will be some prayer that God may, or Allah may, remove that difficulty. That this difficulty will be removed, but they will go back again to their unbelief. And then wait until the mighty punishment will come. If one looks at it like that, it sounds rather vague. Well, you know, what exactly does it mean? But when you analyze it as to what happened after this prophecy was made, is that as it happened with Prophet Moses, peace be upon him, that because of their disbelief, Prophet Muhammad, you know, called on God to punish them for this, to give them a sign that they may heed his message. And historians tell us that after this passage was revealed, actually a great famine took place, and the pagans suffered so much that one of them would look into the sky and he sees it almost like a smoke, and that's what the explanation of it is, smoke or mist that is so hungry that things are so hazy in his sight. It was reported by historians that they ate anything, even the bones they tried to scour, you know, just to keep alive. And it happened also as the passage predicted or prophesied, that they went to the Prophet and said, all right, you pray to Allah. If he removes this difficulty, we will be good. And he prayed, and the difficulty was removed. But again, they went back to their unbelief. The third part of the prophecy that it says, wait until the big punishment will come, because subsequent to this rejection of faith, after even the removal of that difficulty, they were involved in the Battle of Badr, in which again the pagans were soundly defeated. So there was a mightier punishment that was inflicted upon them. And by the way, one of the interesting parts about the Quran is that immediately after these few verses, passages, it mentions also something about Prophet Moses, as if to show the connection between the kind of behavior demonstrated by the pagans and the Israelites also in the early days when they, the pharaohs, the Egyptians, by denial of the message of Prophet Moses. But this is an interesting, if you look at it in terms of the specificity of the mm-hmm. of the prophecies.
Yes, indeed. Well, now you've given us several examples of prophecies, some of which have been more general. Others are related to specific events, as we've just been discussing. Are there other prophecies which relate to specific individuals?
Yes, indeed. And that, again, could be more amazing because, you know, it doesn't just talk about generalities. Well, somebody might say, all right, maybe you can interpret this way or that way. For example, one of the uncles of the Prophet was known as Abu Lahab. If you translate it literally, means the father of flame. Mm. And that was basically his nickname because he had a very fiery temper.
Mm.
And what happened is that in the very early days of Islam, when the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, received the command to declare the message rather than just start with his family, as was the initial stage, family and close friends, to declare it to everyone. And in the famous story when he collected people from different tribes and called upon them, and he stood and he said, you know, if I were to tell you that there is an army behind that hill going to invade you, would you believe me? They said, yes, of course, we never caught you lying or saying something which is not truthful. And then he told them, of course, that I am the Prophet, I am warning you against God's punishment unless you follow his path and all that. After he made that statement, that uncle, the father of flame, he really swore at the Prophet. He told him, are you collecting us to hear this kind of talk? Tabbalak, which means perdition is to you, or may you perish. He, you know, swore at the Prophet. Following this kind of rude response to the Prophet, a surah was revealed, that's number 111, you find it now in the Quran, which basically says that the perishment or perishing would be the lot, not of the Prophet, but of Abu Lahab, or this father of flame. it describes how he and his wife used to hurt the Prophet so much and throw all kinds of things to hurt him on his path, especially at night, that they would both be punished in the hellfire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question may arise here. So what? I mean, what is there by way of prophecy here? There is something here that may go unpassed, unnoticed, or pass unnoticed, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
That not only does this chapter 111 prophesy that he will be punished in the hereafter, which cannot be verified now, because the hereafter hasn't come yet, at least for those who are living. The interesting part about it is that we know from history that there were many people, many individuals who are or who were as bad as this fellow, the father of flames. And they were resistors of the Prophet, they were persecutors of Muslims, and they ended up believing sometimes down the line. So how could anyone make a prophecy with certitude and confidence that that particular Pharaoh will die as an unbeliever that you never believe? And only this can be verified 11 years later when he died after the battle of Badr without believing. How could anyone say for sure that he will not be a believer and that he will die as an unbeliever? Just something beyond the imagination of anyone. In fact, some scholars have added an interesting question here that should be added. That they say that Abu Lahab, or Father of Flame, like many other opponents of the Prophet, were very eager to prove that the Quran is false, or the message of the Prophet is not genuine, or the Quran is his own thinking or invention. And they used all kinds of means to prove it. How come Abu Lahab, that father of flame, did not pretend to be a Muslim just to prove that the Quran is false?
Mm-hmm.
You see, you could have came hypocritically and say, all right, no, I believe now, giving the message to people that the Quran is false because the Quran prophesied that he will not believe.
Mm-hmm.
He could have even opposed the Quran. How come he wasn't able even to do that, unless this is a truth of revelation coming directly from Allah? Another one? Just one more.
Okay.
A very similar case of one individual even. That is believed to be a person by the name of Al-Walid ibn al-Mughira. This was a sort of like of a ring leader among those who opposed the Prophet and tried to hurt him. And used to engage in all kinds of arguments. And whenever he heard the Prophet Muhammad telling certain things about teaching or whatever he receives by way of revelation of the Quran, he used to shout at him, ancient tales, in Arabic, asatir al-awaleen, ancient tales, you know, what's that stuff you're telling us, implying that he might have just copied that from here or there. We find that there is one surah in the Quran, 68, particularly in passage 16, which prophesied exactly what will happen to that individual. One, it is implied from that passage in the Quran that like Abu Lahab, he will not believe until he is punished, that he will live long enough to engage in a fight with the pagans against the Prophet. Thirdly, that eventually he will get hit on his snout, and that this will be a mark of his unbelief. I think to say that several years before this happened, anyone would say this is an amazing speculation, if it's just a matter of speculation. How do you know that he will not believe? How do you know that he will live long enough until the time of the battle? How do you know that during the time of that battle he will be healthy enough to participate in that battle? How do you know that he will get injured in that battle? And how do you know that he will be injured particularly on the nose? And there's no way that anyone can say with confidence that this will exactly happen to that particular individual who used to raise this argument. And time goes on, and this is exactly what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the Prophet get this information if it were true that the Quran emanates from his own thinking?
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, now you mentioned in the last program that there are also additional proofs from the psychological viewpoint that the Quran could not have been a reflection of the experience of Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. Could you explain a little bit further?
Okay. This is an issue that we find many scholars have devoted some, you know, discussion for that, like Sheikh Muhammad Sha'rawi, like Rashid Rida, like Dr. Jaz, I mentioned his name also earlier. And it's a very simple and logical thing. That is to say, if the Quran were the product of the subconscious of the Prophet or his own thinking, whether he realized that or not, then it is not reasonable to expect that that Quran would include correction of the Prophet and even blame for that Prophet. In other words, if you offer something, if something emanates from you, you wouldn't reveal your mistakes and blame yourself especially for mistakes that are not really sin, very big sins or anything, very small mistakes, as you'll see. That's the basic thesis of it. How exactly? Let's turn, for example, to Surah or chapter 80 in the Quran, 80. You find that this has an interesting story. The Prophet, in the early days of Islam, was talking to some of the noble people, or the, let's say, the leaders of their tribes among his contemporaries.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to persuade them to accept the message of Allah and to follow the path of Islam and to give up their paganism and their, you know, evil practices and so on. And at that time, a blind man, a poor blind man by the name of Abdullah ibn Umm Maktoum, came to the Prophet and he wanted to ask him some questions. The Prophet at that time felt that, you know, that fellow is already a believer. He could have asked me that question a little later. So he frowned a little bit. He felt a little bit irritated because that fellow was, you know, pressing for an answer to his question while he was already, the Prophet was busy with those important people. That wasn't really a bad mistake, would you consider it? Some people may not consider it even a mistake at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because in his mind, if he appealed and convinced those respected opinion leaders, maybe it would help guide so many other people to the path of Islam. So it was a very innocent kind of interpretation. Nobody could have noted that at all. Nobody could have even thought that the Prophet was wrong. However, in that surah, number 80, we find a very severe blame by God to his Prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that he should have paid attention even to that poor blind person and establish a different way of looking at things, even though, like I said, it is very defensible what the Prophet have already done. What kind of a person authors a book that blames him for a mistake that people even were not aware of, unless it's something despite of himself and he was perfectly honest in uttering what he received, even blame to himself? Mm-hmm. Another example. In Surah 8 in the Quran, particularly in verse 67, what happened is that after the battle of Badr, this famous battle, the Muslim took 70 of the mighty, strong people of Quraysh as prisoners of war, even though, like I said, the Muslims were outnumbered 3-1. And what happened is that there was some discussion as to whether those people should be returned immediately, should be let free for some ransom, compensation to the Muslim community for their suffering, or should they be held for a while until the unbelievers are truly subdued. The Prophet, with his soft heart, he tended more towards a more charitable, approach, at least freeing them in return for some kind of compensation or ransom to be paid by their people. And anybody, of course, would look at that and say, all right, that's a reasonable approach. It's humanitarian. I mean, there's nothing, mm-hmm. wrong with it. No erroneous behavior on the part of the Prophet. However, we find that in the Quran itself, in that ayah, the Prophet is blamed that the more accurate thing to have done was to wait, because you have to subdue first the unbelievers until you achieve victory and Muslim community is totally secure, and then perhaps the question of returning the prisoners, that could be considered, but not to release them to be a danger
mm-hmm.
for Muslims in later battles. Again, like I said, nobody could have suspected there is any wrong with that kind of decision. But again, the Quran blames him. How could he author something that blames him for such a small thing
mm-hmm.
if nobody even would have noticed? A third example. In the battle of Tabuk, some people came to the Prophet and they asked permission to stay behind and not to participate. And again, the Prophet didn't want to investigate much whether they have good excuse or not. And he simply allowed them, which was militarily too liberal. Mm-hmm. But again, nobody would have said that this is a basic sin or a problem with his decision. However, the Quran comes in Surah 9, in Ayah 43, blaming the Prophet. How come you allowed them without verifying? Even though, like I said, nobody could have objected to mm-hmm. that decision. As narrated in both Bukhari and Muslim, when one of the staunchest enemies of Islam, who was a hypocrite, he pretended to be a Muslim by the name of Abdullah ibn Abi Ubay, died, the Prophet, out of kindness, wanted to pray on him, you know, for forgiveness. But again, we find the Quran in Surah 9, in Ayah 84, blaming and correcting the Prophet that for people who deliberately rejected faith and lived this kind of perverted life deliberately, you should not ask for forgiveness for them. In another case, when his uncle Hamza was martyred in one of the battles, mm-hmm. and a woman was so savage that she asked someone to open his tummy, and she got his livers and started chewing it. And the Prophet saw his dear uncle, who is very staunch Muslim also, in this very mutilated form. And he got very angry, and he somehow swore that he will punish the unbelievers in a similar way. Again, anyone would say that this is only human to say that, even if you don't really intend to do it. But here we find the Prophet corrected immediately in Surah 16, in Ayah 126. It addresses the Prophet to say, when you punish in a way which is similar only to what you, what damage has been done to you. But if you be patient, that is to forgive and wait, it is better for those who persevere. You see, there are even aspects, time is running short, and in fact, to deal with this in detail, there are some aspects even pertaining to the personal life of the Prophet that people didn't have any notion of, even, or not clear notion, where the Prophet was corrected, as you find in Surah 33 and Surah 66, where the Prophet again was corrected in something that he simply did because of oversensitivity, not mm-hmm. because of any deliberate disobedience or anything of that sort. The question basically here is this: how could someone author a book that point out to very small mistakes pertaining to human judgment that anyone can justify and blame himself in such strong terms, unless it is something, again, despite of himself?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the few minutes that we have left, what you've said sounds quite convincing, but I wonder if there are other psychological aspects which would corroborate the conclusion that the source of the Quran is beyond the Prophet himself.
Well, from the psychological standpoint, when we are angry, it takes us a little time to cool down. And you find when you read in the Quran, for example, like in Surah 8, verses 67 and 68, that there's first very strong blame to the Prophet and then forgiveness and acceptance. And this usually in human psychology doesn't happen that all of a sudden like this. There was a case where some of the hypocrites promoted all kind of malicious rumors against the integrity of his wife Aisha. For 1 month he didn't say a word. He could have saved himself and claimed some revelation that she's innocent. He waited for 1 month until the Quran, the revelation came itself, showing the evil designs of those people, and that Aisha, his wife, was totally innocent of this kind of accusation. There are certain aspects in the Quran that verses would be revealed that the Prophet would not know the implication or the meaning, and he waits until another revelation much later come to explain the wisdom behind it. Again, if revelation emanates from himself, how could he have this self-revelation or vision of something that he doesn't understand? One example of that is a verse that was revealed in the Quran that says that you should really fear, if you hide anything or reveal, Allah will know it. And some people were almost in a stage of despair when they said, are we going to be held responsible even for our thoughts? And then again the Prophet couldn't answer until another verse in the Quran came to show that one should try his best, that it doesn't mean what you interpreted. In the Treaty of Hudaybiyah that we can discuss later when we get into history, he took a decision based on revelation, and he never knew how to defend it, and there was almost an insurrection in the army. And he couldn't give any explanation until the wisdom was revealed later in verses in the Quran, much after the action has taken place. So how could that happen if it was his own?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to end on that particular note because we're getting indications that our time for today is exhausted. We want to invite you back next week when we'll explore another major question. We'll examine the possibility of the Prophet having learned the Quran from some other source, or was he influenced by previous scriptures? That's our program for today. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله.